Hello and welcome to Fast and Fair, the Climate Transition Podcast. I'm Paul Fonsail, co-founder of The Conduit, a diverse community of people passionate about positive impact. This episode is produced in collaboration with DLA Piper as part of a series exploring the role of the law in responding to climate change. Throughout this series, we're speaking to experts on climate justice and litigation, policymaking, human rights, finance, and carbon literacy to understand how business, government, and the third sector can work together to speed the transition to a just and sustainable future. My guests today are Alex Tamlin, a partner at DLA Piper, and Lindsay Hooper, Executive Director of the Cambridge Institute for Sustainability Leadership. Alex is head of DLA Piper's EMEA Capital Markets Practice and is co-chair of the firm's Boardroom Advisory Services Practice, which is designed to support the life cycle of boardroom needs. Lindsay leads CISL's education team, supporting organizations and leaders around the world to align commercial performance with the delivery of positive outcomes for society. And alongside Earth on Board, leads CISL's work to inform and engage board directors. Alex, I'm going to kick off with you. Where do you think carbon literacy fits into legal and regulatory duties of company boards?
So that's a real foundation question, Paul, because it opens the gateway to a legitimate discussion in boardrooms about ESG generally. And the answer is going to be different depending upon which country you look at in terms of its legislative response. But in the UK, we've got a statutory expression of directors' duties since the 2006 Companies Act, and that's the first time in the UK that we've ever had such a codification. And within that expression, there is the obligation for directors to act so as to promote the success of a business. And we understand promotion of success in the context of a for-profit business, meaning to make profit. And the concern has been that if you ask boards to concentrate on ESG matters, they will say, well, that's a distraction from our obligation to run a profitable business, because there's a kind of assumption that if you concentrate on ESG, you're diverting your attention from maximizing profit. And that kind of dogma, that received wisdom, has been debunked and discarded for a couple of reasons, partly because of investor sentiment. Investors want businesses to concentrate on ESG matters, and also because of the data that we see that businesses with an effective ESG response actually make more profit than they would have done if they didn't address those issues. So promoting the success of a business is not a contradiction as against running a business profitably. And I think the second point is that the statutory codification requires directors to concentrate on the impact of their business on communities and the environment. So there's an express acknowledgement that one of the regards that directors must have in discharging their duties is to think about environmental impact. And that's absolutely fundamental, because it means we have, from a legal perspective, got the attention of the senior leadership of the businesses that will make a difference in this space.
So that's interesting. So would you say it's fair to say that over the last year, we've seen a complete shift from a relative lack of interest and engagement from boards on climate change to very high levels of board interest? And I suppose the kind of the key question then is, do you think that boards are now providing effective leadership, or are they simply being busy fools and expending a significant amount of time and resource on anything that has a whiff of ESG about it, but really doing so in a kind of check the box way rather than a deep and substantive way?
So a two-part question there. I think in relation to the first point, I completely agree with that assessment, which is that we've seen a step change difference. So we're seeing that many directors have really woken up to the reality that climate change and broader ESG sustainability matters are a matter. They are issues for board attention, and that there's an expectation of board leadership. And as a result of that, we're seeing a lot of demand for board upskilling, for support from external parties. although there are exceptions in relation to your second question about whether they're providing effective leadership, I would say broadly so far, the response seems to be somewhat reactive. So reactive to stakeholder agendas. A lens on this, which has been more about compliance, anticipating stakeholder challenges and expectations and preparing to respond to those rather than proactive leadership in the long-term interests of the business. So some of the contradictions, the dogma that Alex just highlighted, I think are barriers to that effective leadership.
Alex?
Paul and Lindsay, I agree. I think that there's an anxiety on the part of boards now. There's a sense of urgency that they ought to be doing something. But we're not seeing a clear understanding of what that something needs to be. My own belief is that an effective ESG response and the way in which boards should be devoting their energies starts with an understanding of a business's particular ESG footprint. So it would require a deep analysis, shining the light onto the business itself of what the particular challenges and particular opportunities in the environmental space, in the societal arena, represent for that business. And it's only when you have that analysis that you can develop a roadmap along which the business can progress. And businesses which take the time to develop that kind of map and then throw resource at the material components of it will almost always enjoy a greater financial outturn than businesses which take a scattergun approach and throw resource at anything that has, as you say, a whiff of ESG and ESG flavor about it. I think we will see an increasing body of evidence that shows that even quite significant companies that try to respond to everything with an ESG hallmark will actually see a downturn in performance like for like. And of course, that is not something that is helpful to the reputation of the business, nor is it helpful to the brand and reputation of boards of directors and the individuals on it.
So Lindsay, on the assumption that what Alex has said is right, it does really beg the question of how much skill, knowledge, and experience in the climate space, sustainability space, boards need to have. Because in some ways, you know, they either have to become deeply expert on these matters or draw on resource from people who are, or they can set clear targets for businesses and then let the executive execute. And I guess the kind of deeper question is, what is required of boards? What should be left to the execs? What's an appropriate degree of both responsibility and an appropriate division of labor between those two vital parts of a thriving business?
Yes, really good question. And so the question about the setting the ambition, I think that's clearly a really important role for the board to set the ambition for the business in relation to ESG and climate change. I say is necessary but not sufficient. I think more is needed from the board. I think, Alex has used the language of roadmap. I think delivery of the ambition will have implications for investments and capital and resource allocations, even for fundamental business role, business models. So I think the board itself needs to be integrating this into its own agenda, its own decision-making, as well as supporting and challenging the executive to deliver on that roadmap. I think more fundamentally, the board obviously has a role to play in thinking about how this relates to the fundamental purpose, the reason to exist, the strategy of the business, how the business creates value. That's core to the board's role. So I think an important role in relation to climate change, to ESG, to be thinking about the vision, the purpose. What's the role of this business in a net zero sustainable economy, and what are the implications of these issues for the needs the business is meeting, how it's creating financial value through meeting those needs? So I think the board's got a role to play in situating its response to ESG and climate change in relation to its fundamental purpose, how it creates value, oversight of strategy, which is why looking at this only through a compliance issue, I feel, is not adequate. And really importantly, for some businesses, this will require a major transformation journey. Delivery of that roadmap will require transformational change. There'll need to be a sustained and proactive focus of leadership of that change. So I think the board will need to be cited on that, will need to recognise that that will take sustained focus and to be leading, guiding the executive through that change process. In relation to the levels of expertise, yes, I think boards will benefit from having people around the table who have a relevant insight and deep insight into areas. But I think it's a rapidly moving space. So finding routes to stay close to what's happening, to bring expertise in, rather than an expectation that everybody around the table will be an expert. It's a space that will absolutely need the diverse strengths and, great financial acumen, business acumen of existing board members alongside that climate expertise.
Alex, if I read into that, I mean, if you're counsel to a board advising them on what their obligations and potential exposure and liabilities might be, it's probably no longer enough just to say, set net zero by 2050 as your goal and leave it to the CEO to crack on. That you've got to go beyond that. And so, give me your perspective from a sort of legal perspective where those obligations start and stop. I mean, it's a fuzzy line, but something seems to be changing.
It really is fuzzy, Paul. And I think the three points that occurred to me by way of answer to your question, as so often happens when I speak with Lindsay has already covered. So I'm not going to try and break new ground, but what I will do is reiterate some of the points that Lindsay has made from a slightly different perspective. I think the first thing to underscore is the point about change management. What I would be saying to that board, which will expect me to come in and talk about specific legal obligations, is to ask about that board's composition. And I'll be worried if they tell me that they've been preoccupied with trying to get climate expertise or human rights expertise into the boardroom. Of course, I want the board to have access to specialist skill sets, but the thing that that board is going to need beyond all else at the moment is someone who is an expert in change management. Because bearing in mind that the legal obligations in this area are relatively straightforward to discharge, in that if you can demonstrate that you've had regard to an organization's environmental and community impact, that probably gets you over the legal hurdle. If you are authentic and honest with your public disclosures, you much reduce the risk that you'll be sued for them. But in order to actually demonstrate positive impact, rather than set out what you're going to do, but to show that you have done a good thing, you need change management experts. And you also need to understand that there is a big difference between delegation and abrogation. So it's not enough for the board to have one meeting in which they consider ESG matters and then say, right, well, that's now all down to the corporate affairs team or the GC's team or the corporate secretarial team. And we don't need to hear about that in the boardroom again. It'll all get sorted. In order for a business's response to be really effective, the main board needs to understand that while it sets tone for the top, from the top, it establishes values within a business that will encourage the rate and sustainability of change. There needs to be some kind of continuous feedback mechanism so that it is a standing item on board agendas to consider what progress the business has made with its environmental, with its transition planning, its carbon reduction planning. There needs to be constant feedback. So it's something that'll have to be front and center of the board's concerns, not just now, but for the foreseeable future. And if my clients were in any doubt about the fact that this is not a flash in the pan, I would be spending time talking to them about that to get them across that Rubicon.
So Lindsay, I want to ask what a board should be doing when it sets out a roadmap to sustainability, but then confronts what is predictable and almost inevitable, which are barriers at an individual level, at an organizational level, at a systemic level, to executing the kind of systemic change that is required. And how do boards assist, confront, and anticipate those obstacles and barriers?
So the first thing I would say is that I think actually there's we often see insufficient diagnosis or anticipation of these barriers. So a lot of discussion around the ambition and the target setting and the argument about why action is needed is largely one, although we do see pockets of cynicism. But I think that insufficient diagnosis and attention to the barriers is often what we see. We see those barriers and potential solutions at a range of levels. Sometimes the barriers are actually, around the board table. They're at the level of individual board directors. Sometimes that's personal lack of awareness and understanding, we often resulting in a sense of kind of lack of confidence or sense of agency and being willing to challenge. So then being more inclined to simply endorse or leave others to take responsibility. So there's, as a result of that, we're seeing a lot of demand for board upskilling, not, as we said, to be the expert, but to know what to look for, what to challenge for, what questions to ask, to have a frame of reference against which to say, is this good enough? I think also to some of Alex's earlier points around some of the dogma or the contradictions, I think also engaging with some of the dominant assumptions or paradigms, I think there are some ways of looking and thinking about this which aren't necessarily helpful and might need to be addressed and overcome. So perceptions that taking action is an anti-business agenda, or it's a left-wing agenda, or in some regions it might be seen as a Western agenda. So I think really understanding, I suppose, where individuals and the board is in relation to some of these really significant worldviews, or on the role of business. You know, is there a perception that actually business should just follow regulation and should not be stepping up to take action and lead in advance of regulation? Or perhaps an unwillingness sometimes to acknowledge the business itself might be part of the problem, and then may need to be a focus on transforming the business and an openness to that. And I think also clarity on personal agency, back to my earlier point, that actually we see this as something that's relevant to all board directors. It's just part of good business rather than being seen only as the remit of, say, the chair of a responsible business committee, for instance. When we look more broadly at organisational barriers, that piece about aligning the purpose, the business models, commercial strategy, I think that's a really fundamental, often barrier, which often results in ESG climate being treated in a slightly siloed side of desk way. There are some fundamental questions around how the board runs itself, and this speaks to some of Alex's point. So the membership, the competence, the structure, the operations, the agenda, the incentives that are being set for executives, the appointments that are being made, how the board engages stakeholders. So there are potential barriers there if not enough time, attention, competence is dedicated. And then there's a commitment to embedding through the business, recognizing the job isn't done. Simply at the point of the commitment, that to your earlier questions, that overseeing that transition journey, that change journey, needing the decision tools and metrics to be in place, as well as the cultural and I suppose softer sides of the transition. But a lot of the barriers are systemic. It's the economics, it's markets, it's the absence of technologies, it's the lack of data and metrics. And this is where there's a really important role and where there's a need for board leadership and engagement here, around advocating and supportive progressive policy, seizing the opportunity of investor interest to seek investment for necessary resets, for contributing to better data, greater standardization, engaging customers, staying close to supporting, engaging with the necessary tech innovations. So I think there's a huge amount that can be done, that companies do have a big sphere of influence and boards within them have a very significant sphere of influence and opportunity to overcome these barriers.
That's interesting. Alex, I'm sure you have seen boards in which a response to the sustainability imperative has largely been driven by stakeholders and shareholders, and particularly institutional investors who have their own sets of standards and pressures to ensure their investee companies perform well in this regard. What do you think boards can do to be both more proactive, but also take control of the narrative that they're not just doing this in response to pressure, but are genuinely embracing this change?
So that goes to an approach to stakeholders, which isn't necessarily ESG specific, Paul. So in other words, there are some behaviors which will be virtuous. I don't want to describe them as hygiene factors because that makes it sound as if they are more perfunctory, more a matter of box ticking. And we want to steer clear of that. But the recognition on the part of businesses that they can shape investor response. So they can be proactive in engaging with their stakeholders, including their investors, but not limited just to their investors. They can actually take the discussion to their investors rather than waiting for a challenge, perhaps at their AGM, perhaps at their interim results stage, they need to develop a kind of proactivity in their investor relations function. So we've often talked as a firm about the concept of shareholder engagement being an antidote to shareholder activism. So the assumption there is that shareholder activism is generally not a virtuous thing because it indicates a level of dissatisfaction which arises in the first place, perhaps because there hasn't been a clear expression by the senior management of the business, of the business plan and what the senior management is proposing to do to advance that. So perhaps there has been a lack of communication, but there is, whatever the reason, there is a measure of dissatisfaction which causes the investors to be proactive in their approach to management. And that doesn't always mean a lawsuit. Sometimes it can mean a strongly worded letter. It can mean a whole variety of different things, but it is generally not welcomed by management because it's an indication that they've been found wanting in some way. So our recommendation to clients is that they invest more heavily in a proactive shareholder engagement policy. And that doesn't, that shouldn't be misinterpreted to mean a kind of hectoring communication. It's a bilateral process, and it's a process which is designed to do two things: to understand what investor concerns in relation to the business actually are, but also to communicate the business's, the senior leadership's strategy for the business. And that will be an iterative process where perhaps the strategy will be modified in response to investor desires and expectations. And we can see from our own client experience that those boards who invest significantly in an authentic shareholder comms program and stakeholder engagement program will be troubled less by shareholder activism and will find it easier to implement components of the business plan which otherwise might have met with challenge because of a lack of understanding. And all of that goes to a decreased cost of capital and an increased license to operate. And generally speaking, those two things cause a virtual, an enhancement of the business's trust and reputation and standing in the market, which then makes it even easier to get access to capital and a greater license to operate. So that's the, there may be few businesses that can demonstrate a kind of perfect response in all of the components of that equilibrium, but that is certainly the desired endpoint.
Lindsay, what are some examples of best practice in this area? What do you think boards could be doing to be more proactive?
So I think there's definitely space to have a better conversation. And I think investing more in this and looking beyond the, I suppose, the current disclosure requirements to really have an engagement that's looking at this through the lens of long-term value creation, I think is really important. When we speak to investors, we often hear frustration that they'll see a long list of social and environmental commitments that seem to bear no relation to the business's core reason to exist or how it creates value. And on the other side, we hear from boards that they're frustrated that they're being asked for a growing list of disclosures that they know will tell an investor very little about value at risk or the real impact of the business. So I think real scope there to have a better conversation with a lens that is around long-term financial value. So I think a leading response then would be a compelling vision from the business about the role of that business in a net zero sustainable economy. Evidence of a robust assessment, a heat map of its issues, its dependencies, a long-term view of how the business will respond, importantly in a way that creates value, not a laundry list of disconnected initiatives. Obviously, a logical game plan to address the issues. Importantly, near-term plans, not just long-term targets. I think a really important point as well is that there's a recognition this is not all easy in the short term. There are, some of it is not economic in the short term. There will necessarily be some trade-offs. But transparency, I think, is key. Transparency about the difficulties and the gaps. One quote from an investor recently is actually the demonstration that they're trying, that they're aware of this, is 90% of the battle. or you know, we want them to be candid and straightforward about what isn't working or hasn't yet been fixed. It's more reassuring to see this than just missing targets. You know, share the insight, be reassuring to us that you're across it, you understand it might be tough, but you are being really thoughtful about this for the long term.
Alex, I want to ask what I think is a tricky legal question, which is, what do you do when there are competing stakeholder demands or instances where achieving a set of sustainability-oriented outcomes may be in tension with the short-term interests of the business, not the long-term interests of the business? So you need to green your building stock, there's a massive capex requirement to put in solar or heat pumps, you're short of cash that year and you want to do it 2 years' time, but that slows your transition. You're being asked to find out the purpose of your mayonnaise at the same time as selling your mayonnaise. And these can be real dilemmas, and they can be, you know, anti-slavery requirements that stop you from buying, you know, EVs from China at the same time as net zero commitments, which require you to buy the PVs. And if you don't get them from China, they cost you 30% more. These are genuine dilemmas for boards and for management. And is there a good, clear, certain, predictable legal framework which allows people to navigate these dilemmas?
So you want a legal response from me, Paul, and I'm going to give you that. But I think the holistic answer to your question, as with many of the things we're talking about today, it involves a non-legal dimension to it. But I'm not going to get involved with that. You've asked me a straight question. The straight answer is we have two aspects of the law in the UK which are particularly helpful to boards when faced with the challenges you've described. Other common law jurisdictions have similar provisions. So one of those is what we call the business judgment rule, which is that courts will not interfere with decisions taken by boards just because the court would have taken a different decision on the same fact pattern. And in fact, the court will only interfere with the board's decision if it comes to a decision that a reasonable board could not have done what the board in question did. And that, if you are trying to sue a board, that's a very high bar. And if you are advising the board, that's a really a reassuring basis for your advice. So you can say to the board, you don't have to be right, you just have to be reasonable. Now, these things are judged with the benefit of hindsight, but if you can show that you thought about the issue and exercised some independent judgment, if what you do falls within the very wide scope of what a reasonable board could have done, you're going to be okay. Now, the second important component, I said there were two, is that in our earlier mentioned codification of directors' duties, there is an obligation for boards to